All right. Hello, hello, Katie and Kay. Thanks, Grateful Ed, for carrying us through the afternoon, chasing the groove as we do every other Friday. The time is 4:02 p.m., and you are tuned in to Express Yourself here on Katie and Kay for the next hour. My name's the Son of a Gumbo. I got Chris Hassig in the studio with me.
Howdy. And yeah, we have two exciting guests with us, Greg and Jeff Stump. Legends of the ski world.
Hello.
And excited to kick off the show with them on a very auspicious day. Snow falling, not right now, but all morning. And
Jeff claims his day at Snowmass was a delight.
Yeah, tell us about your best turn of the day.
Best turn, well, you know, that you're supposed to keep those secret this time of year.
Oh,
of
people, yeah.
But I'll tell you what, Hanging Valley was pretty awesome.
He'll keep it general.
There's still a lot of good lines in there that are untouched if you know where to look, right?
Yeah. Oh, man.
So Jeff is a private-only instructor up there, so he has days like today when they only stay for an hour, 2 hours, and then, okay, we're going to go. Oh, bummer.
Sure? Can I talk you into staying? Okay, not. Bye.
So, yeah, you two are brothers, and you both have a long history in the ski world. And, Greg, you have made a number of films, and we have all February Radical Wednesdays happening at the ISIS, right?
Yes, yes. They started out with Hot Dog. The movie, which is pretty funny. And Lynn Weiland, the gal that plays Banana Pants, she started out in our movies early on. We knew Lynn when we were just little kids. Yeah. We used to compete together in freestyle. So they showed that. Then we did The Good, the Rad, and the Gnarly last Wednesday, which Jeff is, I say he stars in. I think you should have had that lead credit on that.
Well,
because he's like 24 years old and skiing unbelievably well.
Yeah, Hot Dog and the Mogul, right?
Yeah, well,
in Telluride,
just off the U.S. team, and was feeling pretty good. But we were really fortunate. We had Lynn Weiland again, and Robert Aguirre, and then Eric Bertone, the world champion from France. And you know what impressed me too? I forgot about Craig Kelly was in that movie and snowboarding, incredible.
That one long shot where he's—I mean, you really see how low Craig gets because a lot of snowboarders still stand really straight, but Craig was always like, no.
Style.
You want to pinch the penny? That's how he taught me to snowboard. He said, pretend there's a penny between your knees.
And so this is a snowboarder in an 80s ski movie.
Yeah, we had snowboarding the year before in Maltese Flamingo. We covered the very first world snowboarding championship at Breckenridge.
Uh-huh. Sean Palmer and go on and on. Right. All the
and Sean is like a little 16-year-old kid.
He was tiny. Yeah. You're like, who is this guy? And I traded for a snowboard at that. I traded a pair of skis to a pro snowboard.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, I got to try this.
Well, it seems like one of your major... Yeah, just innovations, I guess, is just pushing the boundaries on what the definition of a ski movie. I did a little bit of reading up and stuff, and it seems like, you know, one thing I was excited to hear, you know, being here at KD&K where we've got the music everywhere, is that you're pushing the boundaries on music in films. Mm. And talk maybe a little bit about, yeah, like...
That was what I think, well, a lot of things set us apart. One, we were young and hungry, and I mean, I think our skiers were far better than anybody that was skiing for Warren Miller, you know, Jeff and Scott Kennett, and you know, later on down the road, we had stole Scott Schmidt from Warren Miller. But yeah, we really had. I feel we had the, you know, way better skiers and music. That was Warren Miller's Achilles heel. Was his music was, you know, that canned needle drop stuff. And we were laughing about Dick Barrymore the other day because Dick used to have a cassette thing, and he'd be editing his movie, and whenever anyone fell or hit a bump, it'd go kish. It's like a cymbal crash. So if you look at Barrymore's movies all through, it's like kish.
But it's like boring production music, and then all of a sudden kish.
Right. Not even on the beat, just when the guy hit the bump or something. But yeah, our music, because we, you know, I developed a relationship with Trevor Horn from ZT2 Records in London, and his wife, Jill Sinclair, actually was really instrumental. But I was getting stuff like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, 808 State, ACT, Propaganda, and then eventually Seal and things like that. So I was, you know, just in a whole different musical realm than Warren was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Good, the Rad, the Gnarly also was the first Jamaican reggae song, or reggae song period, in a movie as well.
Barrington in a ski Levy. Movie, yeah. Yeah,
ski movie. Yeah,
and so wait—that's a song too. Good, the Rad, the Gnarly.
That's the movie. The last week.
Or what was the reggae song though? The
Barrington Levy. Yeah.
Barrington Levy's "Don't Run Away."
But don't run away.
I think it's called "Don't Run."
Don't run away. Cool. But the rest of the music was all original. We wrote, produced, and recorded in Portland, Maine. You know, just my friends. I mean, I didn't play anything, but. I just was the guy in the balcony waving my arms, going, "That sounds great."
And that's where you all hail from, right? Maine?
Gaum, Maine. Gaum. Hey, yep.
Yeah. How did you get into skiing and find your way to this life?
I distinctly remember when we were in the kitchen in Indiana, because our father went to IU, and we had like a family meeting, and he said, "Well, we can either go to Flagstaff, Arizona, or we can go to Maine and learn to ski." And I was like, "Ooh, let's go learn to ski."
So you decided where the family moved?
No. We all voted. All the kids, we all voted. I don't know.
You didn't get a vote then.
No, you were about four and a half, 5 years old.
But I remember climbing a farmer's hill with skis, and then I remember the Kiwanis Club in our town had a rope tow.
Yeah.
And they would, I probably have $1 tickets or something. I don't know.
Family season pass was $10 for the whole family. Yeah. But we went there all, and they had night skiing. So we went, I mean, it was, what? Maybe 300 vertical.
Yeah, it was crazy. But then Dad took us up to Pleasant Mountain, which was in Bridgeton, Maine, a beautiful mountain with a huge lake at the bottom. Well, Moose Pond. Hmm. Lakes are called ponds in Maine.
Yeah, exactly. And ponds are called lakes here.
Exactly. But yeah, and then we got into the freestyle program right away because our ski school director was a guy named Rudy Wersch, and he was from Switzerland, and he could do javelin turns and Royal Christies.
What's a javelin turn?
Jeff?
Just crossing one ski over the other, so you'll be either on the outside ski with the inside ski crossed. That was a javelin turn.
It was like an on-the-ground screaming semen? Or
no, yep. you did the turn on one ski and had the other ski just in the air over it. So it was
okay.
It was the beginning of hot dog and freestyle skiing. Yeah. Those guys were, that's who we followed. You know, we followed.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating to just see how that the whole freestyle world has evolved from, you know, ski ballet into the hot dog world and now into X Games. And it's kind of amazing how the style changes so dramatically.
I was national ballet champion in 1978. Wow. And national champion.
I'm nostalgic for that. I would love to go see that again today, but you can't. I don't think. Does anybody do that, or maybe in Europe? Or
Jeff does. Jeff,
yeah, actually, Aspen Ski School is the only ski school in maybe the world, but at least the nation. And I actually do a ballet ski clinic for the ski pros, so they can teach kids little tricks and stuff. And it's great for your skiing.
That's
the thing that's lost. And I don't put on the tiny skis. It's old school. I do the old school stuff with big crossovers, and you know, so it's we'll give props to Aspen up there for that. And it sells out every year. Like there's only in so many spots, and it's like,
that's
and
cool.
We just have a blast. So yeah, it's still alive, but it's different. You know, it's a little different than it was.
And Jeff, what year were you national aerial champion?
1981.
And we could only do uprights at that point because.
Oh yeah, no inversions.
There'd been the injuries in the pros, so that. Insurance companies forbade us to go upside down. Yes, we were forbidden. Nein, there shall be no flipping.
And so the Good, and the Bad, and the Gnarly was not your first movie, was it?
No, that was my fourth in 4 years.
So what was your first one? That was
The Droids in 1983.
And so how did you get the wherewithal to like make a movie or like think this is something I could do?
I didn't. I
showed
literally,
up and tell your eyes.
You know, I literally woke up one day and declared myself a ski filmmaker. Uh-huh. And Jeff was living in Telluride, and he called me up and said, "Greg, you know, the ski movie you keep talking about making, you really need to come out here." And it changed my world because, like, some of that footage that we showed Wednesday night, that was Mammoth Trees. I mean, the powder was waist deep and you know, nobody there.
And those are all skinny skis, too, so you had to get some speed to float, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we're foiled today with the water skis we got going on. Yeah, so and so then the next movie coming up is Blizzard of Oz, or what?
No, we're doing Fistful of Moguls.
Oh, Fistful of Moguls, sorry.
Which
yeah.
is actually a really good movie. It stars Johnny Mosley.
Uh-huh.
And so we followed him because I hadn't, Glenn Plake and I had a bit of a falling out, and we hadn't even talked in like 6 years. And he calls me up and he goes, Greg, you need to come out and film these mogul skiers because they can't even get free skis in America. Everyone's ignoring them. And it was Johnny Mosley and Jim Moran and Donna Weinbrecht. And
this is in California? Or
this was in... where did
Donna
we
was
from?
Already established, actually.
Yeah, Donna was, yeah.
Johnny wasn't yet.
Yeah. I think we filmed a lot at Steamboat, actually, because they had a designated bump course, and they actually groomed a flat groom track next to the course so we could snowplow holding the camera right at the skiers and keep up with them because, of course, they're skiing bumps. So that made for some really great shooting, yeah. And we shot a lot at Whistler.
Still before GoPros and
yeah, right.
easy follow cam stuff. So the
right.
that one of the reasons why the films were so good. Also, I mean, Greg was a ski champion as well. We had Bruce Benedict. He was a really good skier. All of the
cameramen could ski.
Filmmakers.
You got to be because at that point it's an 80-pound camera, right, or something.
My pack was 75 pounds when I was carrying a long lens and batteries and film's heavy too. Like you pick up a 400.
Everything about it is
heavy.
Almost unfathomable, I think, to today's jibbers of like you just put your phone up and there you've got your like the amount of.
That
amount
battery.
Of production work.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Just...
Well, you see, our helmet camera weighed 16 pounds. It did. And then it was a Gazap camera on one side and the battery on the other. And, you know, it's just this wobbly helmet.
You had to keep it centered. If it got off center,
the whole film is at an angle.
Your neck is at an angle.
Your neck.
Yeah.
It's like, we don't. Yeah.
We finally upgraded and built our own helmet camera with a much firmer, more of a motorcycle helmet.
Uh-huh.
And that worked better. But still, it was, 20 pounds on your head.
Uh-huh.
These guys are jumping off cliffs and things. And they're, the shots of Glenn and Squaw where his neck, I don't know how it didn't break. Just a whiplash.
Well, he had all that mohawk.
Yes, there's all
that
hair in there.
Yeah, I was, Glenn Plake was probably my number one idol in the late 80s. And yeah, he was... always loved seeing him on the screen.
He was, it's funny. Glenn and I, our sort of falling out was that I thought I was responsible for all the success, and that he felt he was responsible for the success. But the fact was, it was both of us. And,
it's like the Beatles, man.
It was, me and Glenn, we were like Lennon and McCartney. Not.
So there's, is that going to be the last film or are you?
That's the last one this year.
Okay.
The final film in the series is Blades of Glory.
Oh, okay. With Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell. I forgot that other guy's name. Oh my God, that's a funny movie.
He is just,
What's it? You know that move they do where they slide in the ice and the Iron Cross and they slide into each other's crotches on the ice. It's just disturbingly, it's just funny. I mean, I can't even look at Will Ferrell without laughing.
Yeah. So what are you up to these days?
Touring these movies is kind of the big thing. And then I'm into buying crappy houses and fixing them up and making them really cool.
Uh-huh.
So.
And Jeff, here in Snowmass, right? Or
yeah, in Carbondale.
In Carbondale, yeah. I've seen you around.
about a little over a year in Carbondale. I was 20-some years up in Basalt.
Uh-huh.
And like many of us, we keep just going further down valley.
Yeah, follow.
But
gravity.
I've always loved the community down here, and of course KDNK.
Yeah, so. And you're still within striking distance of Powder, so.
You bet.
Yeah. No, Fistful of Moguls is really, really good because it chronicles Johnny from 2 years before the Olympics and Glenn telling me that he's going to win. And so the movie takes place over a two-year time span, and then he wins the Olympics. So it's got a happy ending.
That's great.
The other great thing I think about that is, and there's a local, John Clendenin and Wayne Wong, who's over in Deer Valley now, I think, but those guys showed up. And so I was actually behind the cameras at this point as well for that particular segment. And to have Wayne Wong and Clendenin skiing with the young up-and-coming hotshots was definitely, I think that was another great part of the movie.
And the music is fabulous.
Who's in this one?
It's mostly driven by Trevor Horn and Dudley Lowell Cream and Paul Morley, Art of Noise. So they were Art of Noise. So it's mostly Art of Noise music. There's a bit of...
And are they writing original stuff?
No, but they happen to have released an album, right? But, you know, well, I was in production, so I was just able to pull all these tracks. They took Claude Debussy's orchestral music and turned it into like a pop sound.
Wow.
Yeah. With, you know, Trevor's stuff is all very super produced. And it's just really great stuff to edit skiing to. I don't know. I was just reading a review from back in the day, and Skiing Magazine said it was my most beautiful film to date.
Just gorgeous.
Just gorgeous. Just lovely. Smashing.
Nice.
But it's really, it's a good movie, and the show's a bunch of fun at the ISIS, and of course it's all goes into helping Aspen Film.
Yeah, and it's happening next Wednesday. What time is it?
Doors are at 6, and the movie's at 6:30, so it's early. But after the film, we have a rockin' after party at Aspen Collective.
Cool.
DJ Watkins' latest gallery. And it was really fun. I mean, we had people coming in off the street, just walking down the street in Aspen. And
that's the beauty of that spot. It's right in the middle.
Yeah, and oh man, he's got such great Hunter Thompson shotgun art.
Yeah.
The Johnny Depp stuff. And
did you engage with those folks at all and stuff when you were back in the day? And did you guys spend much time here, in the, or were you in Telluride when you're doing most of these films, or are you kind of on the road? I guess
we filmed here a bit early on. Jeff was remembering more than.
Yeah, we filmed Maltese Flamingo. I used to come on photo shoots every once in a while. I'll come up from Telluride and and ski, excuse me, ski and do some still shots for people. Cool. So it was definitely always awesome to come into Aspen in those days. Like I think I was telling you too, I'd go through Carbondale, and of course Telluride was a small town then. I go, wow, this town is cool. It's a little town,
dirt streets, the old days.
So so it's gonna be a big party Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. You can get tickets, and I advise getting them in advance to go to aspenfilm.org.
Yeah.
And they're only $15. They're $12 if you're a member of Aspen Film. But so it's like $15. I mean, that's less than the popcorn.
Yeah, and they're a great organization. They need some help to keep their doors open and doing their all the great programming they have. So it's a great way to support them and support Greg and Jeff. And it's such a pleasure to have you here in the studio. Two legends here in the Katie and Katie.
No, I love coming to the studio because it reminds me of a radio station I used to work at in Maine, WBLM, The Blimp, and it was just a blast.
Yeah, they were waxing about the records and stuff.
Yeah, a real record collection in a radio station.
Waxing about wax.
Yeah. We were waxing about wax.
Well,
I always wanted to do a fake ski shop called Full Moon Waxing.
Okay.
Which, is, of course, doesn't exist because the full moon only wanes.
Well, someday we're going to come have you in as a guest DJ, I think.
I'd love to do that.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in. And, that's again Wednesday at 6 p.m., 6:30, or 6 p.m. for doors, 6:30 for the show. Go to aspenfilm.org to find more information and tickets and stuff.
And we sold out last week, so do get your tickets in advance because...
Yeah.
There were a few disappointed people at the door.
Oh, no.
we had Kleenex for them.
And, I'm going to kick it back over to Tracy, I guess.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Jeff Stump and Greg Stump, for stopping by the KD&K Studios. And, we would love to have you guys back sometime in a DJ manner. So
let's do it.
Let's make it happen.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks for having such a great station. It's inspirational that something like this still exists.
We're very honored to keep the legacy going. We're almost 42 years old, and in April we'll be 42. So
love it.
Nice.
All right. Thanks so much, guys.
You bet. Thank you. Take you
Don't you be afraid to lose control. If your heart espouses empty spaces, dance is just a thing to make you whole. I am one who dances with the mountains.
Everybody, you are tuned to Express Yourself here on KD&K. My name's Tracy, aka Son of a Gumbo, and I am joined now from the Earth Law Center. We've got the Executive Director Grant Wilson and Ombudswoman Joni Klar. Joni and Grant, how are you doing today?
Never better, really, never.
Great to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you, happy to talk about what the Earth Law Center does, what you guys have going on later this afternoon and this evening, as well as Saturday morning. So I will just let you guys kind of take it away, and let's find out what is going on and what people can do if they want to join you guys this weekend.
Thank you, Tracy. I really appreciate it. I came to Aspen in 1971, waiting for you guys to open here in 1986, okay?
In 1983, actually. You only had to wait 12 years. That's
yes,
you're a patient
yes.
woman.
Yep. But I had become an ombudsman when I studied at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark for years, and was so impressed with their politics because I was a political science major. I was going to grow up from South Dakota, from the farm and the rodeo, and be the first woman president of the United States, just fix things. That's what we do. Especially if you were born in Hubert Humphrey's farmhouse. That's quite a legacy. But anyway, I've just always enjoyed that. And Denmark is such an amazing country. It just offers urban planning, architecture, the history. So for me to end up in Aspen and be part of this community, I was appointed to the Planning and Zoning Commission, which was just a dream come true. And I brought all that background from my farm and rodeo in South Dakota and the Danish, European, Scandinavian system of governance and equality and fairness. And so we wrote the first growth management plan for Aspen that was adopted everywhere after that. And what we wanted to do, we thought, when the developers come, let's give them guidelines of what our sustainability goals are so they know. And they know they can compete for open space, employee housing, renewable energy, all the factors that, working with John Denver and his organization and the Rocky Mountain Institute, and my rodeo background, that just all made sense. So that's what got me going.
Well, I think there's still time for you to make that presidential run there, Joni. Grant, how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, sure thing. Let me quickly introduce myself. My name is Grant Wilson. I'm the executive director at Earth Law Center. I am a lawyer for the Earth, and I mean that literally, that the Earth is our client. We represent rivers, forests, and ecosystems in law, and work to give them a voice in the legal system and work to give them rights. Humans have rights. Corporations have rights. Shouldn't nature as well? And how I got into this field was as a young environmentalist, I was both enchanted by the ability of nature to restore itself to health and really thought to myself, wow, what if nature could come back? And this especially struck my imagination growing up in the Pacific Northwest and seeing wolves come back for the first time in 80 years. And I thought that was just so incredible that we can take so much from nature and it can come back. But then I also saw one of these first wolves who returned to Washington be poached and wondered, you know, why is there this humans against nature mindset, and really explored that as a lawyer and found that in the law there's this understanding that humans are separate from nature, that humans are superior to nature. I found out that all life is treated as human property. Water, forests, oceans, species, they're all treated as property under the law. And I wondered why this was, because, you know, as I came to understand, humans are just one small part of this much larger interconnected web of life. And what if the law reflected that as well? And so the past 12 years, I've been what I call an earth lawyer, and now run Earth Law Center, which works all over the world to create new legal frameworks that give nature a voice or rights or a board seat or a day in court. And this is something happening quickly in countries worldwide.
Yes, and we are all we are governed by the earth. We like to think it's the other way around, but we need the earth to survive. The earth does not need us to survive. And I think the more we can get that through our thick skulls sometimes, the more we can coexist, because the earth is going to be around a lot longer than we are, most likely. And I think it's great. When I was doing some research, looking through what Earth Law did and what you've done specifically, Grant, like you just said, giving nature, giving rivers, giving mountains the same rights that we afford human beings, and treating those natural entities as people with rights and with a voice. I think that's just a step in the right direction, and something that we all need to wrap our heads around to sustain our existence as humans on this planet. Joni and Grant, why don't you let us know what you've got going on this weekend? There was already an event earlier Friday morning. That's today in our fantasy world. We were actually doing this interview on a Thursday, but we're pretending we're all in the studio on a Friday. So we had the event. What's the event that already happened Friday morning?
Yes, we had a lovely event at Art Base in Basalt, because we want to work with all the artists in the world to get the message out, because artists are part of nature and our message and our heart and spirit and culture, and certainly in this valley that I've been part of for all these years. And there are messengers. And so to honor Art Base, which represents local artists focusing on nature, Mother Earth, their message, you know, our culture, creating the most amazing culture is in this valley. Of anywhere in the world you go to, you won't find what we have developed over these years, from the Ute Indians that were here. This is their land, and I work with them closely and do ceremonies. Every time I do an event, I usually have them to do the blessing as well. And so we did that at Art Base.
And big shouts out to Art Base for everything they do in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Yeah, so Earth Law Center is a global organization. We're working in 20 countries, sometimes more, to establish nature's rights and voice in the legal system. down in Peru, giving rights, supporting the case that resulted in rights for the Marañón River, with indigenous women appointed as the legal guardians of the river, or working in Nigeria to establish rights for the river Ethiop. But where our international headquarters is based in the Rocky Mountains, down south a little bit here from Durango, where I just drove from up to Aspen and the Roaring Fork. And so this is a really special place for us. If we are learning of these innovations happening worldwide that are so exciting, we want to be able to bring those to our home in the Rocky Mountains. And so, you know, we're here this weekend to share information about what's happening globally, and then also to connect with community members who really care about the rivers and ecosystems here and might be interested in new innovative legal tools to give them a voice in local politics and government. And, you know, Joni, who's been doing sustainability work here for decades, you know, helped write these first sustainability plans, is sort of a return to that history in that, well, yeah, sustainability was really great to stop some of these environmental harms and start to respect nature. Now there's this whole new wave of ways that we can look to government to give nature a voice, and we're excited to introduce some of those to the town. In addition to the event we had this morning, there's a couple more I can talk about now, if that's a good time.
Absolutely. We got something going on at 5:30, just 30 minutes after this show is over. What's that? A guy you might have heard on the station before.
Yes. What we're doing is, I've been part of the John Denver. I was on the Windstar Board of Trustees for many years, and I've always felt that I take John's spirit, as we all do, into the world. And right now we have the sanctuary. It's the heart and soul of Aspen for me, is the John Denver Sanctuary on the river there. So since this is the whole theme is about writing the poetry and the love letters to your favorite river of your heart, what a perfect place to be is there at 5:30 at the sanctuary. And Joe Henry's song, I Wish I Were a River, is one, an amazing song that he's gifted us with for the event. And then at 7, from 7 to 9 plus, we will be at Aspen Shakti Yoga Studio on Hyman Street. And we will be continuing to celebrate this with all of us together.
If I could add a little bit about the 7 o'clock event at Aspen Shakti, basically the idea is it's Valentine's Day. And, you know, we have many people we love, but I think many of us love a river. And folks are going to come. They're going to learn about writing poetry, about writing love letters, and they're going to get the chance to write a poem or love letter to a river that you love. And you're also going to learn a little bit about the work of Earth Law Center. As a lawyer, I'm writing love letters to rivers all the time in the form of rights of nature laws. We worked with a group called Save the Colorado, or now Save the World's Rivers, to recognize legal rights for the Uncompahgre River, for example, down in Ridgeway. And that's our form of a love letter as a lawyer, but literally folks are going to get to come and learn about our work and come away with a really special gift. The only requirement, the only thing we ask back, is that they actually go to the river and read the poem or love letter at some point, because I think it would love to hear that support from folks.
I think our listeners who have been tuned in this week will be very familiar with the love letter format. We had a love letter station in last Friday set up at Chacos Park in Carbondale, where members of the community could write love letters to pretty much anything they wanted to. And I know we just had one read yesterday that was a specific love letter to not only the Roaring Fork River, but all of its tributaries, which I didn't have enough time to even read on the air. But there's just so many different streams and brooks and other rivers that flow into the Roaring Fork and make this watershed so important. And so that event at the Shakti, the Aspen Shakti Center, is from 7 to 9 this evening. And I believe there is an RSVP that if you want to RSVP, the website is givebutter.com /riverlove. Again, that's givebutter.com/riverlove. And is there a fee to enter, or is it just everybody's welcome, and just RSVPs are encouraged so that it doesn't get too full of all these river lovers?
Right. You know, we're a nonprofit, and we're trying to do more of this work in the world. So anyone that makes a donation is happy for. But we just want everybody there, because when people discover this work, it just strikes your heart, because it's right what we're all doing one way or the other. And it's nice to know that there's a bigger umbrella that we can experience now as well, and take that into our lives and our businesses, our schools, our governments. I've invited our Pickens County commissioners. We have a whole beautiful system of governance that Grant can talk to more, that is the missing link to making the next step.
Yeah, and anyone who comes and writes a poem or love letter, and by the way, whoever wrote that one already on their own accord has to come to the event. So if you're listening, please come. You're our VIP guest. But anyone who writes a poem or love letter will also have the opportunity for us to share that with our mailing list, which is thousands of people across the world who are actively working to give nature a voice and rights. And hey, maybe it'll spark a whole movement of showing our love for rivers. So yeah, anyone's welcome. Come on down.
All right. We are talking with Joni Klar and Grant Wilson from the Earth Law Center here on Express Yourself. And if you're just tuning in, the Earth Law Center, along with Save the World's Rivers and the Why on Earth community, are throwing some events this weekend. We just talked about what's going on later on Friday evening. We've also got an event Saturday morning at the Aspen Chapel. Did you want to talk about that a little bit as well?
Yeah, sure. So 9:30 a.m. at the Aspen Chapel till about 11, we're going to hold an event on law and spiritual ecology. So certainly we're going to talk about the rights of nature. And actually, if you look at many religions, if not all, there's so much written about the sacredness of nature, about how humans have a duty to be stewards of nature. And in addition to talking about our work to use the legal system to give nature rights and a voice, we're going to talk about some really interesting fables, and specifically one called The Animal's Lawsuit Against Humanity. And this is a 1,000-year-old fable based on a tale out of India, written by an Islamic scholar that was later translated into Hebrew at the order of a Christian king. It's all these different Abrahamic religions and traditions that came together. And 1,000 years ago, someone wrote this tale of animals suing humans in the court of the spirit king for their poor treatment. And basically, it evolves into a debate of, are humans superior to animals? And the humans in this court say, yes, we are. Animals are on all four legs, and they don't have culture, and they don't have free will. And the animals, rebut these arguments. They're like, we're on all four legs because it's convenient to eat grass. And actually, like, bees do little dances on flowers when they pollinate. I call that culture. And we don't have free will. Well, you do, and look what you're doing with it. What's that say about you? And it was translated from Hebrew by this amazing person named Rabbi Anson Leitner, and we did a whole play of it in New York City. So we're going to talk about that story and kind of weave together current legal movements, because, the work we do now at Earth Law Center is essentially representing those animals in the court case and saying, hey, you're not just property, a thing. You have a right to exist. And, you need lawyers to figure out how that works, because there's a lot of unraveling to do of the way we treat nature now. So 9:30 on Saturday, I hope to see a lot of folks there too.
And we're also, I just wanted to mention, we have a special guest Friday night, another author and attorney coming that I wanted to mention.
That's right. So Professor Karen Bradshaw is coming to the Friday night event at 7 p.m. at Aspen Shakti, which, by the way, Aspen Shakti is generally co-hosting this event with us as a sponsor, so thank you to them. Professor Karen Bradshaw is coming from ASU Law School. She wrote a book called Wildlife as Property Owners. What if wildlife could own the property that they need to thrive? That's obviously not something that is traditionally thought of for how property law works. But there's all these earth lawyers out there who are saying, hey, we can like reimagine parts of our legal system to give nature a voice. And it's not that difficult. And so she's going to be here. It's incredible. She's coming with her own poetry that's been written for nature and is someone you don't want to miss, one of the world's leading experts on ecocentric law.
Also, Aaron Perry, and the founder of Why on Earth and a sustainability icon in this valley for the last 30 years, is one of our partners. And his poetry is just unbelievable. That's part of this journey also. And you can find about us. We're in the Aspen Times. We're listing all four areas today, yesterday, and tomorrow. So we're looking at the Aspen Times, and you'll find the whole program that looks pretty cool.
All right. And if our listeners want to learn more about the Earth Law Center, what's the best place for them to visit?
Definitely go to our website, www.earthlawcenter.org. I really encourage you to sign up for our newsletter because you'll hear about instances happening frequently in the Global Biodiversity Treaty in countries throughout Latin America and Africa and Oceania and even in the United States of examples where nature has been given rights, a voice, a board seat, all of these really exciting innovations. So sign up for our newsletter. And if you just have 3 minutes, I know people have short attention spans these days. If you have 3 minutes, go on YouTube and watch our hype video. It's a great introduction to what we do, and we'll get you excited about our work.
And our Elwha River 15-minute documentary that's standing room only when we show it at EarthX and other places. It's on the website, and it will just – you go, oh, my God, this is so great. It's a whole model of what we're doing and what we will continue to do, especially the bigger our team gets.
Well, thank you, Joni Klar, and thank you, Grant Wilson from the Earth Law Center, for coming on today on Express Yourself. If you are out there and you want to learn more about your local watershed, there's a great website run by the Roaring Fork Conservancy. It's just roaringfork.org. And you can learn a whole lot of stuff that you might not already know. I know we got a lot of knowledgeable listeners who could probably spout that off the top of their head. But if you don't know as much as you might like about your local watershed, definitely check out roaringfork.org and don't be afraid to make your way to these events on Friday night and Saturday morning as well. Thank you guys so much for stopping in. And this is Express Yourself on KD&K.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Heard you had some trouble. Thought I'd try to help you. In my time, I've had a little trouble too. If you let it get you down, you know I'll bet you it will get you down and walk around on you. Sweet misery, she loves her company. She's in a crowd when she is all alone. She doesn't care, follow you everywhere. She is most happy when she makes you moan. My dog had some.
All right, and we are back here on Express Yourself on KD&K. Great to be with you here with Laura Dartmans. Am I saying your name correctly?
That's correct. Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
And you're a working ceramicist, and you have a show coming up. Tell us about it.
It's actually open right now at CMC in Aspen. It's an exhibition called Intimate Immensity, and it's a collection of ceramic works, also with some steel thrown in there as well. And it's on until the 17th of May, so it's a really exciting show, and it's a collection of work that I'm really proud of and really had a lot of fun making, so I'm happy to see it out.
And you're going to have a reception next week, right?
Yes, next week on Wednesday at CMC on Wednesday at 5:30 p.m.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to come and listen to an artist talk if you're around in the area. That'd be great.
Yeah, you could maybe squeeze both that and the ski film in if you're up valley. So, tell us a little bit about how you came to make ceramics and your journey to this show.
Sure. I've been working with clay, maybe 15 years now. And I just started out just kind of messing around like a lot of people. I joined a community studio and I was making, you know, little functional work. And then I was, you know, really fortunate to have an opportunity to go and live in Japan for a few years. And that kind of sealed the obsession. I made a lot of work there and I met some really great artists. Was really fortunate to meet a wonderful mentor who introduced me to wood firing, which is a process of working with kilns that are fired with wood. And really kind of fell in love with the material. And, you know, I think back now, that was maybe 10 years ago that I was in Japan. And I think that obsession with material has kind of really pulled through to what I'm doing now, that the work is really about materiality and about engaging in those processes. And I think, without kind of that start 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have got to this work now.
Uh-huh. So what was the name of that mentor?
His name is John Dix, and he's originally from Michigan, and he's been in Japan for 30 years. And he works out of Sasayama Tamba, and he works with really beautiful clay from the Shigaraki region. And he builds kilns, he fires kilns. He comes to the States every summer and kind of fires about the place. So, yeah, if you're interested in wood firing, check out John Dick's work. He's amazing.
And does he do more functional or sculptural stuff? Or
a bit of both, yeah. He kind of, I really love what he does because he navigates this space between functional and sculptural. And, I think the way that he plays with material, like, it's definitely something that's so inspiring to me, that a material can do so many things, and that it's not just about, I guess, being able to name that thing and it be, you know, a functional object, but being able to let the material work in different ways and work with sculptural forms, and then to bring sculptural forms back into functional work as well. He's got a really exciting way of working, and I find that really inspiring.
Uh-huh. And so these pieces, I would say, are decidedly sculptural rather than functional.
Definitely.
Tell me about your relationship with those two sort of aspects of ceramics.
Yeah, I mean, I love making functional work, and I still do make functional work. I find that really peaceful and very predictable. This process kind of takes things the other way of being very unpredictable, and the purpose of this work is to not know what's going to happen. So I think a lot about the unknown, and this process very much lends to unknown discoveries. When I started making this work, it was very accidental, and I've kind of learned to embrace, you know, accidents and risk as part of a process.
Wabi sabi.
Yeah, really just kind of letting things happen, but in a thoughtful way and through a very deliberate process. But, you know, sometimes things happen that I couldn't have planned, and they're really great accidents. And so I really try to embrace that. When I started making this work, I was doing a lot of functional work, and, you know, I remember this one day I started messing around, and I actually dropped this piece on the floor, and I was kind of like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, and I've got a photo of, I remember that day that I took a photo of this kind of deformed blob of clay that fell on the floor, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I could work from that and see what would happen. And I mean, at the time, you know, it was during COVID, and I didn't even have kilns. I was just kind of messing around. And it really kind of opened up and liberated the way that I was making. So it's,
that's cool.
Sometimes those accidents can be really good discoveries.
Yeah. And now has that also led to this more composite nature of the work, where you're starting to introduce other materials? Or was that already in your work before that?
No, that definitely came up through this kind of discovery process. I guess in that same period when I was messing around with these new forms, and I didn't really know what they were for or what they would do or how they would work. And, you know, I was out walking and I found these like railway pins, and I thought they were kind of fun to play with. And, you know, the idea of play
like
has become
tie the rail to the tie.
Yeah. The kind of the brackets that would go under the old, wooden
that the
posts.
Pins go through kind of, yeah, or that the spikes go through. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the spikes. So I had all this like steel detritus from these railways that were being pulled up near my home. And,
In Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm from the Southeast. And we have, like here, we have these beautiful rail trails, but these railways have been pulled up and the scraps are kind of lying around the place. So I found them a really fun kind of I guess it was a stimulus or a challenge that I really love these objects, and I had these ceramic pieces that I was playing with, and it really did set me off on this process of play that has allowed me to kind of see work literally from other perspectives, turn it around and see it new, mm-hmm. but also to introduce steel as an element to help me prop the work and also complement just the discussion around materiality and how those materials talk to each other.
Yeah. Wow. So, and yeah, so tell me a little bit about how you found your way from Australia to Snowmass Village.
Yeah. It's been a journey. I came out here for grad school in 2022. I came out and was in New York and did my MFA out there at SUNY New Paltz, and I was really lucky to come out here to Anderson Ranch Arts Center as an intern in the summer, and went back to New York, finished grad school, and last May when I graduated, I was really fortunate to get a job here at Anderson Ranch. So I've moved up, I've been here since last summer, and yeah, it's a beautiful place to be. I'm very happy to be in mountain life.
And are you coordinating ceramic? Tell me about your work at Anderson Ranch aside from your art making.
Yeah, so I'm working with the artistic team there as the artistic programs manager.
Cool.
And I have a studio there and making a bit of work. And, you know, there's a beautiful arts community here as well. So I've found some opportunities to exhibit my work and, you know, connecting with some really beautiful people, obviously through the ranch, but Carbondale as well. There's an amazing arts community here, and it's really lovely to meet other ceramic artists, other sculptors, and lots of beautiful creative energy.
I feel it's a cool balance of sort of insularity up there where you can kind of retreat and be in this secret little snow globe world with your work and your projects. And so I was a resident in 2016 or something.
Uh-huh.
And, it was fantastic. But then also to be able to, have this access also to kind of community and workshop things with your
absolutely
you know,
yeah
a
it definitely
audience.
Is a snow globe, especially today. It's quite surreal coming from like rolling green hills and coastal South Gippsland. it is a wild change for me, and you know, even compared to upstate New York, it's you know, there's a beautiful community there as well, but it's just, you know, different pace. And I know that my work will change while I'm here. I'm not quite sure how yet, but happy to kind of keep exploring and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. And were these pieces fired at Anderson Ranch then for the most part, or?
No, this was work that was part of my graduate exhibition that I finished less than a year ago.
Uh-huh.
So this was all made and fired over in New York.
Uh-huh. Have you been able to use the wood kilns at the ranch though?
I haven't yet. When I was interning, we did fire when we had some visiting artists up. I haven't fired them on my own for a while. This work is actually gas fired. For anyone who knows ceramics, it's a cone 6 reduction firing. And I'm really kind of obsessed with copper reds and, you know, really playing with the chemistry of what happens in a reduction firing. And, you know, a gas kiln and a cone 6 kiln just offers a quicker process to experiment and play with.
Yeah, some interesting color work as well. That's a whole other dimension.
For sure, yeah. I think, you know, actually making the work itself, like the clay work, is actually quite quick. It's quite intuitive. It's a lot of prep and a lot of thinking. But, you know, by the time I'm making the work, I can actually make a form in really under an hour. But the big obsession for me and the big focus of my time is really on glaze work. And, and a lot of the transformation happens during firing. A lot of things break. A lot of things evolve in ways that I don't expect. And then, you know, I use a lot of glaze fusing and refiring. Some things go through 6, 7, 8 times to fire and build up color layers. So glaze chemistry and that kind of work is a big part of the process.
That's kind of like black magic or something.
It's very unreal. The magic of that, it totally is. It's you know, I think a lot about like the magic of materiality, even though it's actually chemistry going on, but there's something that happens that's really unexpected, and I think as long as I keep pushing and playing and being curious, it's going to keep evolving.
So this show, you have like what, 10 or 15 pieces in this show? Or
I think maybe 10 or 12, maybe 12 pieces.
And you have the whole gallery at CMC Aspen. That's right there across from the airport. It's pretty easy to get to. You don't have to go through the S-curves. It's a great gallery space. So if folks haven't, and it's a little underrated, I feel like people don't know about it that much, but it's a great space. It's up there at the CMC Aspen campus.
Yeah, they're a great team there. Lauren Meyer she's fantastic. And the space there is gorgeous. They've done a really good job of, providing that space. And I'm thrilled to have this work out and to be seeing it again.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to be your next state step in this evolution on this stuff?
I just want to keep exploring, you know, and I think one step at a time, as long as I try not to think too far ahead. You know, it's usually the things that I plan don't go to plan, and the things that I don't plan are the greatest surprises. So I'll keep working. You know, this method and this process that I'm working with is really exciting. So as long as I just keep one foot in front of the other, I've got a show coming up later this year out here at Carbondale Arts in their beautiful gallery space. There is lovely. So
October,
I'm showing there. So I've got a good challenge myself now to keep making some work and keep thinking, keep reading, keep making.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Laura Dortmans. Her show will be having a reception at CMC Aspen at 6 o'clock on Wednesday. 5:30.
It's okay.
On Wednesday, what day is that, the 19th?
I think
maybe?
It's the 19th, yeah.
And go check it out. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
All right, Trace.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for Express Yourself today. Thanks, Chris. Even though he's behind the scenes, thanks Cody as well. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed some John Denver, since we had the Earth Law Center, who's doing something at 5:30 tonight at the John Denver Sanctuary. We decided some couple John Denver songs would be fitting. So appreciate Joni and excuse me. Joni and Grant coming on earlier, as well as Jeff Stump and Greg Stump. So thank you, everybody. And this has been Express Yourself. The Carbondale Arts Posse will be back in the chairs next week, as per usual. And we appreciate all of our lovely Katie and Kay listeners tuning in today on Valentine's Day. So much love out to everybody. Hope you all got some nice turns in this morning like I did. And yeah, this is Katie and Kay, Carbondale Community Access Radio. See you soon.